You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2014 on Monocle 24.
Covers of tributes, pages of analysis, and a new sense of purpose on editorial floors. Today, we review the newsstand from the continent, 1 week after the attacks on Charlie Hebdo. Today, from Switzerland, on this special edition of The Stack. We start today's program at one of the better mass newsstands in Europe with our editors.
It's been interesting seeing the newspapers around the world divide about how they cover that story and what their interpretation is of freedom. So I think for many of the news media, it has been that moment where they've had to kind of look back at what they really believe in and what they're willing to do.
And we're also in Paris on the day that over 3 million copies of Charlie Hebdo hit the streets.
Bonjour, il reste encore des exemplaires de Charlie Hebdo ici?
Non, j'en ai plus.
Bonjour, il reste encore des éditions des numéros de Charlie Hebdo ici?
Non. Tout était parti le premier 15 minutes.
All that and much more on a week that has changed the face of European media. Right here on the special edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print, review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to a very special edition of The Stack, coming to you from what I believe is one of the better stocked newsstands you'd probably find in the center of Europe. We're in Press and Books. It's part of Kiosk, which is part of the Valora Group. And we're standing in one of their more premium outlets, which is at the heart of St. Moritz. Now, I'm joined by our editor, Andrew Tuck, and also our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. As we're saying in the intro of the program, we've been through an extraordinary week. And here we are standing in the midst of a very, very well stocked chain store as well. I mean, this, what's interesting about this newsstand, you find Press and Books all over Switzerland, in parts of Germany, Andrew. One thing when we're always in this environment, we're sometimes a little critical, feeling a little bit sad about the state of the newsstand in the UK and other markets, because here you have this really extraordinary density of magazines. And I'm just looking around, and of course we're in Switzerland, so you would expect that there are German titles and there are going to be French and Italian, but you've also got Portuguese and you have Russian, and certainly serving many of the markets that are of course coming up here for the winter holidays. But I wanted to just kick off with this quite remarkable week that we've seen, not just in print media, but media in general. And I think before we sort of maybe dive into and look at the covers and what's surrounding us here, just your reflection, whether you've even been looking at electronic media, what you've seen on television, really almost where we've ended up since those mass rallies in Paris last Sunday.
Well, looking at the print media, I think the fascinating thing is that they have become the story, because the idea of whether the cartoon should be published when Charlie Hebdo brought out its new issue, whether it should be printed just as a cover, whether it should be ignored. You know, what did the newspapers think about this debate about freedom? Now, many of them have been able to dodge it for a long, long time because they didn't want to republish the old Mohammed cartoons. They felt, perhaps quite rightly, they were simply inflammatory. But this time, they needed to take a stance. And it's been interesting seeing the newspapers around the world divide about how they cover that story and what their interpretation is of freedom. So I think for many of the news media, it has been that moment where they've had to kind of look back at what they really believe in and what they're willing to do.
Mm. It's interesting, you touch on print. One thing we were talking about even before we went on air, though, it's put a lot of the broadcasters in a predicament as well, because they've had the luxury almost of being able to dodge these covers for quite some time. Our foreign editor and our executive editor, Steve Bloomfield, is here. Steve, your take, you know, on that, because again, this moves away from being a political statement, particularly if we're talking about the rolling news channels. It's very hard not to show this because this is core to the subject.
I think they've really struggled when it's come to the, certainly the new issue of Charlie Hebdo, which came out this week, in that this is the news story, the fact that 3 million people were queuing out, you know, very early in the morning to pick up their copy, to then say, actually, we don't feel we can show you the cover, I think was quite difficult for some news channels. Some actually then did feel comfortable showing it, I think partly because it was a relatively innocuous cartoon on the front. But it certainly throws up all those issues of free speech, of how you editorialise. And I think, you know, one of the challenges that all news organisations have had is the freedom to publish is also the freedom to choose not to publish. And many news organisations may well have felt, we don't want to print this, we don't want to publish this or show this on TV because we don't think it's right. And that surely is our freedom to do that as well.
Andrew, we've had a discussion about issues of security, not even within our own building, but I think a broader discussion about what this means for any type of editorial organization. You know, here we saw that Charlie Hebdo was, of course, protected. There was two police officers assigned out front. They had round-the-clock protection, as did the editor. What happens on newsroom floors moving forward, not just in Europe, but certainly in the US, I think, you know, other markets that also, you know, feel that they're really at the front end of this. You know, is there a sense of immediate panic? Let's, you know, erect the blast barriers, let's assign more security officers, and then do you think we see a scaling back again? Because I think we're all of the belief that, yeah, there's only so much, you know, there's only so much you can do, and in a way it sort of flies in the face of why you're there as a media organization, that there needs to be, of course, yeah, a level of security for your staff, but you also have to be open and transparent.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that I think all the big news organizations, I would imagine if you were the BBC, for example, in the UK, you would have been putting more security people on your front door. You'd been cautious, even more cautious about people's access to the building. Now, those organizations, in a way, have something in place anyway. It's the smaller magazines. You know, Charlie Hebdo was not a big organization. They will always be vulnerable to someone who arrives at the front door with a gun, whether or not there's a policeman standing there. I think what's more intriguing is what it will do to that notion of self-censorship. And I would imagine that there are many young journalists working for news organizations who realize, you know, that they're easy to track down. They're on social media. They give away huge amounts of information about what they're doing every day. You can track them wherever they are. Now, are those people going to be willing to put their names to stories which are critical of the Muslim stance, critical of the Muslim community? Are they going to be willing to back Charlie Hebdo? Are they going to be willing to support the publication of the cartoons if they feel that their news organizations can't come and stand beside them and protect them?
Mm. Steve, maybe we can pick up on the security issue right away, but also your thoughts on a next generation of journalists, or even journalists who are currently on the editorial floor. I think sometimes, you know, we have a discussion, maybe, you know, we were trained up at a very different time, and sometimes we feel that maybe younger journalists today, you know, don't want to push it. They've grown up in an era of, you know, call this political correctness or not. But do you worry about not just self-censorship, but also the distance that maybe young journalists will go in the future?
No, I'm actually quite optimistic about, you know, how young journalists will deal with both this and other issues. It always astonishes me that there are, certainly just in the UK alone, there are thousands of people who come out of journalism schools every year, and there are very few jobs for them to come into, and yet they will still go onto those training courses, they'll still go to those journalism schools, and there are many that will become journalists without even that training as well. It's still a profession that people want to get into, and for most people that want to get into it, certainly news journalism, they want to get into it for the same reasons as we did. They want to tell stories that they feel aren't being told. They want the rest of us to know things that we don't know at the moment. And the young journalists that I meet and speak to, I think they have that fire burning just as much as we all did when we began.
Just maybe we can talk a little bit about what we saw from last Wednesday, and I think probably this story, you know, demobilized by Sunday evening, really, after the rallies in Paris. And we were talking about, and I know there's probably a difference of opinion here, but we've seen on a lot of the international news sites, they enter into this live print coverage, or at least print on a digital screen, where you have a news desk who are aggregating, of course, feeds coming in from all kinds of places. It's social media. They might be putting up video as well. What's your sort of take on this new type of live reporting, as it were?
Well, I think we saw that many of the news organizations just don't have the people to put on the streets to cover these events. That's the first issue. And even some of the bigger organizations that do, they shove someone down on the street, they're there with a microphone, shoving it in various people's faces. There's no sense of, you know, them searching through the crowd for the more interesting voices. Then we see this kind of Twitter feed running up across the screen all the time, as though that was kind of, you know, the analysis that the audience was looking for. So it felt much of the coverage was very thin. And I think that one of the big breaking points was actually the coverage of that demonstration. I don't think they knew what tone to take. So for many of the news organizations, they were commenting on it like it was a, you know, a festival or a fair, and they were using the words like enjoyment. And I don't think that really they understood what it really meant for France at that time. So many of the outside news organizations seemed to kind of struggle with even kind of contextualizing it. So then to be dependent on what people were saying on Twitter running across the screen seemed even worse, I think.
I think you found, certainly on with some TV networks and also some newspapers as well, there's a real difference between those that had Paris correspondents and also had people who had been Paris correspondents on their staff who they could send and spoke French. You know, very simple thing, but actually, you know, there were news organizations that sent people that, who didn't speak French. But I think, Tyler, your point about these sort of rolling live news blogs that you find on some news websites, some of them I find quite useful. I think if I'm following a story hour by hour, you know, they can run very well. It's when they get into, here's the latest I've heard, and here's a tweet from our correspondent, you know, with a tiny bit of colour here, you think, you know, surely there's a better way of actually crafting this story rather than just instantly posting the next thing you thought of, the next thing that's come up.
Mm. We've heard a lot about standards and practices this week, and whether we're talking about Mohammed and what is in the BBC's guideline book, but do you almost have to take a couple of steps back from that, Andrew, and say, we've somehow arrived in a place where so often we heard, you know, anchors or people out in the field, you know, with completely uncorroborated reports, not just sort of, I have heard, it's someone who is ex-State Department who was talking to somebody at Defense who says this, and then not only is the presenter talking about it, it then also ends up on the ticker at the bottom of the screen. I don't feel that that would have happened in a newsroom, in any sort of rolling news organization 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, I think especially on some of the US networks, the so-called experts were being rolled out to kind of give comment and to try and put, you know, some a frame around the events. They seemed very lost with what was happening.
Do you think that was because they were backfooted, as Steve was saying, we've seen a demobilization of correspondents, people who did it well still have Paris bureaus, they still have people there. We're also in a state today where there's just less reporting in terms of, you know, good old traditional packages analysis. How many people can you trot out on a satellite feed?
Well, I think that's the issue. There's less reporting and there's more, we have our analyst, we have our expert, and that is our reporting. So a lot of the US networks, you know, CNN and Fox in particular, instead of actually sending their defense correspondent out to get a story, they will have, here's our defense analyst who's in studio, who gives us his view on what he thinks is going on. And that is then seen as the reporting. And that's not reporting. Mm.
You're listening to a special edition of The Stack. We're coming to you from Press and Books in Samaritz. When we come back, we're going to actually look at some of the titles here. And we've got this week's edition of Die Zeit. We've got Der Spiegel and many more. Stay with us.
As Design Miami celebrated its 10th anniversary this year, Monocle Films explored new themes in the collectible design market.
I think that we're beginning to become more of a design-driven culture as we learn to consume more responsibly. We're beginning to learn that better design helps us actually live better. And I think America's finally waking up to that fact.
Pull up a chair to watch Design Miami 2014, now playing in the Films menu at monocle.com.
You're back with a special edition of The Stack here on Monocle at 24, coming to you from Press and Books in Samaritz, which has to be, as we were saying at the top of the program, one of the better stocked newsstands that you would find, certainly one which is part of a big corporate conglomerate. I'm here with our editor, Andrew Tuck, our foreign and executive editor, Steve Bloomfield. Both are flipping through some of the news because they were standing in front of one of the stands in this magazine store, which is devoted to much of the weekly press. Steve, you have a cover of Stern, and also there's a special pullout that they've done inside using the Stern white star on a red background with the Je suis Charlie across the front, and are running, of course, one of the images, which, of course, we saw from the week before. Talking about print right now, did this story matter? Is it a different type of story because it was on paper?
Yes, I think to a certain extent it was. And it's interesting looking at, you know, the German news weeklies and how they've differed, certainly from, you know, in the UK and in the US, where they've very much shied away from showing any of the images here. Stern's got its own tribute to the 17 victims of these attacks, and also then reprints a number of the covers from Charlie Hebdo. As you see, there's some mocking the Pope, there's some mocking Prophet Muhammad, there's François Hollande, I think with possibly Marine Le Pen in bed there, looking down at something underneath. You know, it's very clear that this is, you know, it's reiterating that point that it was a magazine that took on everyone and anyone. And it's a story that obviously both Stern and Der Spiegel as well have given huge coverage to. They've obviously gone with, you know, showing solidarity and saying, you know, these are our people and we're here to celebrate them and defend them.
Hmm. Has this become a curious, unfortunate in many ways, rallying cry for newsroom floors, editorial floors? It's interesting looking at here, Stern, a Hamburg-based magazine, Der Spiegel, a Hamburg-based magazine. And then, of course, we saw at the weekend an attack, looked like a firebombing, on Hamburger Morgenpost, Andrew. Does it give a different type of energy and metabolism, not to just journalists on the floor, but also those people sitting around boardroom tables as well?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is looking at the German media is just how well they do these stories. Again, looking at Stern, you know, the picture desks on these organizations, they work very hard. They've pulled together something that's pretty amazing, showing some quite graphic photography from inside the offices, which I think most other European newspapers have slightly shied away from. But the metabolism in the boardroom, I hope that people realize that this is, again, a moment where all these newspapers, magazines have to publish these stories. That's the energy that's really around it. It's the silence, it's the complicity of other news organizations in not taking part that in the end kind of makes it easy to target one organization. So the Stern story is amazing. And also the thing about Stern is they're always good at infographics, at linking those stories together, explaining it in a very detailed way for a broad audience. I think a really great, great example of Stern.
I just want to step back a couple of days. Incredible to think that last Saturday we heard about the possibility of a print run for Charlie Hebdo, which was going to maybe reach somewhere close to three, well, initially 1 million. Then by the start of the week, we heard that print run was going to go well north of 3 million. And also sort of, you know, looking at, you know, continuous run-ons even after that. We have a report from our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson.
The sound of the freedom of the press coming under attack from jihadist gunmen here in Paris, resulting in the loss of 12 lives at the offices of satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo. This attack, and the others which followed during the next 2 days, left France in a state of shock and with a sense of horror shared by many other countries with a steadfast commitment to freedom of speech. The massacre brought more people out onto the streets than any other event in French history. And on Wednesday, 1 week after that attack, a new edition of Charlie Hebdo hit the newsstands on schedule, confirming that this latest attempt to silence it had failed. On the newspaper's front cover, a caricature of the Prophet Muhammad, bearing a sign which carries the now world-famous phrase, "Je suis Charlie," and above it the words, "All is forgiven." Originally, plans were made for a print run of 1 million copies. That's 20 times the normal number, but it quickly became clear that this would be nowhere near enough. 4 million more copies have now been printed in various different languages, and when this so-called survivor's edition of Charlie Hebdo went on sale on Wednesday morning, most kiosks sold out within a few minutes of opening their shutters. I joined the queues in an attempt to get hold of a copy.
Do you have any more copies of Charlie Hebdo?
No. No more copies. Zero copy.
Il reste encore des exemplaires de Charlie Hebdo ici?
Non, il n'y en a plus. Vraiment, il est fini. Épuisé.
Merci beaucoup. Bonjour, il reste encore des exemplaires de Charlie Hebdo ici?
Non, j'en ai plus.
Bonjour, il reste encore des éditions des numéros de Charlie Hebdo ici?
Non, non. Tout était parti le premier 15 minutes.
Est-ce qu'il reste encore Charlie Hebdo ici?
No more. There was a huge queue at 6:30. Lots of people were here. We didn't receive many copies in any case.
What was the atmosphere like this morning when all those people lined up to buy a copy?
It was chaos. Lots of people who swarmed to the kiosk and we sold out immediately. Yes, it really was chaotic.
Have you ever seen anything like that before in your career?
No, nothing like this.
Unprecedented scenes there, as this latest edition of Charlie Hebdo sold out in record time. But how was it that a new edition of this publication was produced, and on schedule, with so many of its editorial staff dead and a newsroom destroyed by gunfire? Well, the answer is that the left-leaning newspaper Libération invited the remaining Charlie Hebdo staff to carry on working at their nearby premises. I asked Libération journalist René Kaplan why she thinks that decision was taken by her newspaper to help Charlie Hebdo in its hour of need.
Well, Libération and Charlie Hebdo already are cousins to some extent. What do I mean? They are politically of the same flavor and the same color. Charlie Hebdo is somewhere on the extreme spectrum, generally left-leaning. It depends on what your opinion is, but they're definitely on the left side of the spectrum. Libération is definitely a left-leaning newspaper. They're both puckish, mischievous, clearly seeking humor and using and sometimes abusing humor. There really is a lot of similarity in tonality, and even, in fact, geographic proximity. Their offices were close to each other in Paris.
It must have been incredibly difficult to put together this edition of Charlie Hebdo, the so-called Survivors edition. Tell us a little bit about how it was put together with so many of the talent, so many of the cartoonists no longer with us.
That's probably one of the unanswerables, and I think one of the important unanswerables of how it happened. In fact, there was a lot of secrecy and a lot of closed doors and a lot of people and journalists and cameras and recorders not admitted to the newsroom, in part because the idea is no matter how many people you kill, slaughter, eliminate, exterminate, we will survive because we are more spirit than we are people or unique talents. We are in some ways indestructible. That, in any case, was the message they wanted to put out there.
Many people will be thinking it's one thing for Charlie Hebdo to have pulled it off this week. A huge amount of interest internationally in Charlie Hebdo, and they've managed to, they're very likely to sell their 5 million copies, perhaps even more, who knows, in all these different languages. But do you think moving forwards, Charlie Hebdo is an institution that's actually going to survive?
They'll survive in the short, maybe in the medium term, in no small part because there was a big influx of funding, not just for this edition, but for future editions, probably more money than they've seen in years, precisely because they've been struggling. They've been struggling financially. I mean, it's a scrappy publication by identity and by choice to some extent. But it's also a brand of humor that is not necessarily as timely as it used to be. It's very deeply French, rooted in a sense of 1968 sort of revolutionary opposition, when opposition for its own sake was enough of a political stance. There is a sense of it being a little bit dated, a little bit out of step. A lot of people don't necessarily agree that that kind of gratuitous provocation, and very much a conscious gratuitous provocation, is relevant anymore today. This may give it some lease on life. It is a good question as to just how long a lease on life.
And that was Libération journalist René Kaplan speaking to me there. I also spoke to French cartoonist and comic book author Jérôme Béjani, who goes by his artist's name of Jérôme. He knew some of the victims of last week's attack on Charlie Hebdo and has been asked to contribute some of his work to a tribute book for the victims of that attack. I asked Jérôme to tell me more about the individuals who lost their lives in the Charlie Hebdo massacre.
They were really lovely people. They were funny. They were harmless, and they liked to make a joke and take the Mickey out of everyone, not just the terrorist or the prophet. Or they laughed about the Catholics. They laughed about the police. They laughed about the politics. They laughed about themselves.
And so do you think this edition of Charlie Hebdo, this latest one, the Survivors edition, do you think it will be the last one ever?
No, I think it's going to go on. It's going to be hard work for everyone involved in Charlie right now to keep on working because it's so hard emotionally. And the amount of work, I mean, they killed more than half of the talent of the newspaper. So it's going to require a lot of organization and work and courage to go on. But even if the newspaper were to die, Charlie will never die now because it's more than a newspaper.
So what do you think the legacy of Charlie Hebdo is?
The legacy of Charlie Hebdo is that the French people stood up for their right to express themselves and to express their opinions. When they say we are Charlie, is what they're really saying is that you will not make me shut up if I want to express my opinion.
Tell me what it meant to you as a cartoonist to see the kind of outpouring of grief, the outpouring of emotion that we've seen here in France the last week or 10 days.
It was comforting to know that people care, that free speech is so important in France, that people want to be able to say whatever they want. They want their journalists, their artists, to be able to express their opinions, and that people are not going to submit to the rule of terrorists.
And that was French cartoonist and comic book author Jérôme Béjani speaking there. France is still stunned by what happened during those 3 days, from the 7th to the 9th of January, and commentators have been busily trying to agree on just what effects these tragic events will have on French society. The answer appears to be that France is more united right now than it has been for many years, and that a renewed sense of pride has come to the fore. Pride in what it means to live in a country which tolerates every opinion and which will stand up to anything or anyone that tries to undermine that freedom. In the words of the French president, Charlie Hebdo is alive and will live on. For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
Our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson. You're listening to The Stack here in Monocle 24. I'm with our editor, Andrew Tuck, our foreign executive editor, Steve Bloomfield. Thoughts and reflections, Andrew, when you heard that this was going to go up to 3 million, of course, an incredibly impressive number. The proceeds from that going to the victims' families. What happens over the coming weeks? Do you think that there's going to be certainly not the same momentum? We're not going to see, you know, those types of sales probably 2 or 3 weeks out. But does it do something for not just the state of the weeklies in France and other markets, but even the daily market as well?
I think what we'll see, you know, obviously the sales figures for Charlie Hebdo will fall away and will return to, you know, a more sensible level, you know, in the sense of a sustainable level. But I think that what we'll see over the coming weeks is that actually there has been a bit of a shift in the newsrooms. I think that people feel that they need to engage with the story in a way that they hadn't before. I think it is a sense of, especially in France, people feel that something about France has been deeply attacked. And I think it's going to be slightly intriguing to see how much the gloves stay off. I think that many of the newspapers have come out in a very kind of strong way to say that actually, no matter all the questions around, you know, being integrated and what we think of different faiths, in the end, there's this core principle, which is even more pronounced in France, about being a country of freedom, not religiously bound, and that you are able to say what you want. And I think that that sense of freedom of speech, it'll be interesting to see how it gets played out, but it's going to be a top topic for the coming weeks.
Steve, do you think that brings about a rewrite with brand books, handbooks, guidelines and practices in many organizations now as well, and we're not just talking about how companies run their security, but also what their new editorial line has to be, or do they have to revisit old editorial lines at the same time?
I think we're already seeing that. You know, for example, the BBC had a situation last week where they had one of their main presenters saying, reading out the BBC guidelines live on air and saying, we can't show any images of Prophet Muhammad. And then a few hours later, a BBC spokesperson saying, oh, actually, that's old advice. We haven't really worked out what's happening next. And then another BBC presenter feeling, you know, confident enough to show the new Charlie Hebdo front cover. So I think it's a conversation that's ongoing at all news organisations about how they tackle issues like this, and it's one that will continue. I mean, I think that the key thing is going to be in the next 12 months. We've got a series of elections across Europe, in the UK. There's some local elections in France, elsewhere in Europe as well. Sweden obviously is coming up very soon too. And this issue of immigration, of integration, of many different cultures, many different faiths, is going to be at the forefront of many of those elections. And it's about how, you know, obviously politicians have responsibility to deal with this properly, but news organisations also are going to have to think about how they cover these news stories. You know, as much as we may want to ignore the National Front in France, they're leading the polls. They can't be ignored. So how do you talk about their issues and what they're saying in a sensible way?
Andrew, just before we go, and you've been gazing around at this newsstand, we're standing in the corner of an L-shaped, two walls, with titles covering everything from German art and culture and Italian magazines devoted to interiors, and you've heard sort of in the background people from the village coming in and out and buying their press. Just as we wrap up, there seemed to be a certain role for analysis. I found that I really couldn't wait because up here the British papers, the Sundays, they arrive a day later. So you really wanted to dive into, at least in the UK, the role of the Sundays playing a little bit of the same part that the Germans' newsweeklies do, and the same thing as we were talking about Der Spiegel and Stern, that real critical role where these magazines can really take a look back. Does it give you, just in our own business, a sense of optimism? At the start of the year, I'm sure many people many media organizations are probably not feeling very good about not just the money they're going to be spending on paper, but just their overall outlook.
Well, we need to move on from Stern. We've given enough praise to him already, but that is the example of what you need. It's looking over my shoulder. There's even some of the often more tired titles have brought out specials looking at, you know, what's happening with the jihadist movement. It's on the cover of The Economist. All of these organizations have been galvanized. And I think that's the great thing, that, as you're right, you go to TV, it's such a kind of rolling news context these days. There's very little analysis. You go online, it's the same sense of blogging, bringing you up to date. You don't want to read 5,000 words, 10,000 words in a morning online. So it's when you pick these magazines up, you realize how essential they are in moments like this. That's the way that you'll get some, you know, really great voices and be able to sit back and contemplate what these people have got to say. Yeah, I think it's a great moment for the newsweeklies.
Andrew Tuck, our editor, Steve Bloomfield, thanks very much. And that brings us to the end of this very special edition of The Stack from St. Moritz. This show was produced by Tom Edwards and our team back in London, David Pleasant and Claire Urban. Of course, we're here every weekend on Saturday. For me, Tyler Brulé, goodbye.